Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hi, Fiona. We find ourselves in a completely different place from usual, don't we?
We do. We're in a rather glamorous hotel room, and we are about to interview someone that we are incredibly excited to talk to, but we're having a marvelous time at the Franschhoek Literary Festival.
We are, absolutely. Fiona, how has it been for you so far?
Well, it's been fun to be here, not as an author, but as a spectator, and just to choose panels that I feel like going to and enjoy the markets and all the good food. How has your first panel been? Because you were invited this year.
I am lucky enough to be an invited guest this year, and I had my first panel where Danielle Weekly interviewed me and Nikki Greenwall, and it was really lovely. You know, I've been on a lot of panels by this stage at various literary things, and sometimes they just have a magic, and this morning I felt there was a magic. I really loved it. I could stop my festival now and feel good about it. So it's been lovely, and it's just so magical to be here. It's particularly good weather. I feel like I sound like a cricket commentator. But it's particularly good weather for Franschhoek at this time of year. It's often a bit miserable, but we're having sunny, sunny days, and it's just magnificent.
Yeah, I think we would both agree that for people who have not been here before and had this experience, I know it's not cheap and it's a bit of a schlep to get here. It's not on anyone's way to anywhere, but it really is worth it, isn't it?
I mean, absolutely. If you live in Cape Town, you don't have any excuse. If you live in Cape Town, just get yourself here. And it is cheap if you don't have to fly here and stay here. But it's just, if you are an avid reader, this is an experience that I think you can't better. It's amazing.
And Gail, I have to ask you, did you bring your laptop with you, and have you done any, or are you planning on doing any writing?
So I tried very hard not to bring my laptop with me, because I think it's actually pathological that I think I can't travel without a laptop. My laptop came with me, but it hasn't been out of the bag. So I don't even know what I think I was protecting myself again. I certainly haven't tried to do any writing. I've literally been on the move every minute that I've been awake since we got here yesterday evening. So I don't think I'm certainly not going to try and write this weekend, but I'm hoping I'm going to take the energy home and write well next week. Touch wood.
Yeah, I also tried to leave my laptop at home, but I have this fear that I'm suddenly, the muse is going to visit me as never before, and I'm not going to have my laptop, and that's going to be the most terrifying scenario.
And obviously we couldn't possibly write with a pen on a piece of paper.
Okay, so we're both delusional, but
we both have codependent relationships with our laptops, I think, is actually what's going on here.
Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
So I feel like for once, I am watching TV on trend, and I'm watching the thing everyone's talking about, which is Four Seasons. And it's magnificent. It's a story set over 8 episodes, 2 in spring, 2 in summer, etc., about a friend group that is thrown into disarray when one of the men leaves his wife. And it's personal, and it's funny, and it's clever, clever writing, and I loved every minute. And we watched, trying to watch only one a day, and then at the end, like, watched 4 on the last day. Have you watched it, Fiona?
I have, and I enjoyed it so, so much. And it's so on point for our stage in life, isn't it?
Oh, completely, completely, because it's people whose children are grown up, and it's a friend group that have lasted all these years. And, you know, we do, I think all of us have at this age, you do have those friends whose partners have changed since you first started out, and especially people like you and me who are married to their original husbands and look to stay married to their original husbands. So I related very hard to the one couple, the long married couple. It was wonderful. What about you, Fiona? What have you been reading and watching?
I have been reading Chimamanda Adichie's Dream Count.
That's certainly more intellectual than my answer.
I would say it's got just about as much drama in it, to be honest. But it has garnered some mixed reviews online. I was waiting for someone I trust to tell me that this book is good and that I should be reading it. And your writing partner, Kate Sidley, was that person for me. She said, no, this is lovely. You must read it. So I did. And yes, it is lovely. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's so intelligent. It's so beautifully written. It's so insightful on so many topics. It's basically four women telling their stories in their own voices. And I can see why it hasn't hit for some people.
Okay.
Because there's a certain repetitiveness to one of the themes. The dream count pretty much refers to a body count, you know, which the kids these days talk about, you know, how many yes. people have you been with?
Oh, that
with?
Kind of body count. I thought you meant dead bodies.
Oh, no, live bodies, Gail, live bodies.
Teenage body count, not mafia body count.
So these are adult women talking about their body count, and there's maybe a section where the bodies just get maybe a couple too many for interest, where perhaps the reader loses interest slightly, and perhaps a harsher editor would have asked the author to cut that. But even with that, it's almost a flawless novel. She is brilliant. She is a genius. I won't tolerate anything said against her. She's wonderful, and I loved that book.
Okay, I'm going to take that as my sign that I better get reading.
So someone else that we both love and admire so greatly is our guest today. Our guest today is John Boyne. John is the author of 18 novels for adults, 6 for younger readers, and a collection of short stories. His 2006 novel, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, has sold more than 11 million copies worldwide and has been adapted for cinema, theatre, ballet, and opera. John has won 3 Irish Book Awards, along with a host of other international literary prizes. His novels are published in over 50 languages. John, I think we have managed to convey how excited we are to have you here with us today. Hello and welcome.
Thank you. It's my second trip to South Africa, so it's lovely to be back.
As Fiona said, as we've told you, we are not in our normal state of clear thinking. We are completely fangirled. We are so excited about this. We're so grateful to you for doing this for us. And we're going to jump right in. Just because you're special doesn't mean you get to avoid the question everybody gets. How has your writing week been?
Well, slightly strange week because I started it in Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare country. And I was doing a festival there. I was being interviewed, and then I was interviewing another Irish writer, Cecilia Ahern. And then I came back for a couple of days to Dublin, and then I flew here. But I'm in the middle of a second draft of a new novel at the moment. And it's one of those where I'm really, really enjoying the writing process a lot. So it's been a little bit broken up in the last week, but every kind of spare moment I get, I get back to it.
And when you aren't on book tour and you do have time to devote all your hours to writing, what does that daily writing process look like?
Well, I'm an early riser anyway. I would usually be at my desk by about 8 o'clock in the morning. But I'm not one of those people that says I have to write between this time and this time, or I have to get this number of words done. I'm more somebody that by the end of the day, I want to feel that I haven't wasted my day. So I'm fortunate enough, I get to work from home. That's where my office is. So I'll start there in the morning. I'll do a little bit. Then I'll read. Then I'll, you know, do all the stuff we normally do, like put the laundry on, all that type of thing. Then I'll do a bit more writing, a bit more reading. I'm sort of in and out of the office through the day and working on a scene. And maybe sometimes I'll be in there for like 90 minutes, maybe sometimes only 30 minutes. So I just kind of work it in and out. And then I very rarely will do anything after around 7 p.m. I'm not really a nighttime writer. But I just like to feel when I go to bed at night that I've achieved something with the day.
And that achieving something, does it look like a word count? Does it look like a particular scene? What does it look like?
I guess it just looks like the feeling that the book has moved on another bit. So say in the second draft at the moment, there's a lot of short scenes in the book. So I'm kind of looking at it like that. Doesn't have to be one a day, but that every couple of days I get another one almost signed off as a second draft one and move on to the next before, you know, working my way to the end.
And have you always worked like that, or has your writing process changed over your long career?
Well, at the start, I had what I suppose we would call a real job. You know, I was a bookseller in Dublin when I published my first few books. And I used to get up very early then. I used to get up about 5 a.m. to write before going into the shop. And that was really good for me because I liked going into the shop knowing that I'd got maybe another 2,000, 3,000 words, you know, or whatever it was, down. And that whatever the day held, you know, if we went out for drinks after work, whatever, that my work was done, the book was moving along. And then when I became a full-time writer, it probably became more like the way I've just described it, where I'm sort of in and out of the office and work like that. The other thing that's changed a lot, I would say, is for the first 5 or 6 books I wrote, I would plot out the books very much in advance. I knew what I was writing when I would sit down for the first draft. I don't do that anymore. I haven't done that since about 2007. Now I just start with an idea or a character or a theme. I put down a sentence and off I go, and I just see where it takes me.
And do you think that's a product of being confident that you've done it so many times, you're going to be able to do it again? Because it's scary if you've been a plotter to suddenly turn into a pantser and just write.
Yeah, but a what?
A pantser, you write by the seat of your pants.
I like that, a pantser. I like that. I'm going to use that. I think it's exciting for me. And I feel that I wouldn't sit down and start writing a novel if I didn't feel confident enough in myself that the idea that I'm working from is one that's going to sustain me for the next year, year and a half, and that will produce an interesting book that I can, you know, will end up hopefully people reading. So I wouldn't just like start without ever having given it any thought. But I guess over time, yeah, you do start to feel confident. You feel, you know, where confidence really comes in, I'm sure you find this, is that in one of those drafts where you just feel like, I don't know where this is going, or is this any good? But where you tell yourself, but I'm going to figure it out. I trust myself to figure it out, and that I'll, whatever, even if I've gone down the wrong alleyway in it, I'll find my way back to something and be able to chop bits off at times. So
maybe that was the advice I needed today. I think I might leave now. Thank you, John. You've done your job.
So, John, tell us about your earliest days as a writer. When did you know that you were going to be a writer? How early did you start? Tell us your origin story.
Very, very young. I'm talking about sort of 8 years old. I had a obsession with paper and pens, with all sorts of stationery. Even today, if you leave me in a stationery shop, I'll just buy loads of stuff that I don't need. I used to write stories taking characters from books that I was reading and write new stories. And I used to bind them up and put my name on them and put them on the bookshelves in my house, my parents' house. And even as a kid, when, you know, the parents of your, or your friends of your parents would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? I always said, I want to write novels. And they always used to laugh, because I guess when an 8, 9, 10-year-old says that, it sounds very precocious. But in my head, I was like, no, I really do, though. Like, I knew the effect books had on me. I knew the effect going to the library every week had on me, how important it was in my life. And the books that I was reading, I knew, because I was, like a lot of writers, I suppose, I was quiet and introverted a little bit, maybe as a kid. And I knew how important books were to me. And I just always had that sense inside myself that this was what I was supposed to do. That's what I was born to do. And all through my teens then, I really started taking it very seriously. You know, I was writing stories all the time. I was sending them out to magazines, to places, trying to get them published. And I started getting a few published, you know, towards the end of my teens and early 20s. And I was doing an English degree in Trinity College Dublin. And then I did a creative writing master's in Norwich under Malcolm Bradbury. I finished that when I was about 23, 24. And my aim was, and I was getting at that point, I was getting a good few stories published. And my aim was, I wanted to get a novel published before I was 30. And I wrote a couple of novels, as I suppose most novelists do, that just weren't good enough, but that taught me a little bit more each one. And I published my first novel, The Thief of Time, 6 months before my 30th birthday. So I just pulled it in under the wire.
And those early books, you know, when you were still one of us in the trenches, before you were a big, big name, how were those early books received? How was that early part of your career for you?
Well, they were pretty much ignored, to be honest. The first 3 books I published, The Thief of Time, Congress of Rough Riders, and Crippen, they didn't really do anything at all. But I was young, and it didn't really matter. It was for me, it was like, but I'm published. That was what mattered. And by the time I came to write my third one, I had just enough money in the bank to be able to say, right, I could take a year now and focus, you know, on this without having to work, because I'd worked seven years in the bookshop. And then I wrote Boy in the Striped Pajamas, and everything changed on that front, both in terms of the ability to, you know, financially support myself in it, but also the attention of the reading world. But I didn't feel too bad then in the first few. I just thought, well, they're published, they're in the bookshop. That's all I had wanted. Nowadays, I feel like it's 25 years later, and certainly with Irish writers, they do expect instant success, and English writers too. I often speak to young writers at things, and I sometimes get the sense from them that because the stories they read about are the debuts that do really, really well, they forget that every debut that does really well, there's another 100 that do what my first book did, which is nothing. And the trick is that it's difficult to get your first novel published, it's even more difficult to get your fourth, fifth, or sixth. That you have to keep working and not take it for granted, especially if you don't get the good fortune of having something like a Striped Pajamas happen, where everything changes. But I think people expect that kind of level of success very, very quickly these days.
So these days, I think that authors are very much encouraged, or at least are aware, that they should be trying to brand themselves early, that you should be known as the thriller writer in that sphere, or the young adult writer in the sort of romanticy sphere or whatever. And you've done quite a few hard pivots in your career very successfully. Was the fact that your initial books hadn't done as well as you hoped, did that give you the courage then to do something completely different with The Boy in the Striped Pajamas? Or is that just something you've always done? You've always been willing to write whatever you want without an idea of crafting this very intentional career?
It would be the latter. I had no plans in terms of always trying to be some sort of brand or genre type writer. The strange thing writing Striped Pajamas was, of course, I was writing for a young audience, which I had never done before, but it didn't seem that important to me. It was like, well, I'm writing this book, it seems interesting, you know, I'll just carry on and write it. And those early books were all historical, I suppose. And then over time, I became more personal in the books, I think, where they were based more on my own experiences. And I started writing about Ireland at one point. So I've never felt that my publishers expect anything particular from me. And some of the books I've written have been a little bit out of left field in terms of the other ones. That, for example, The Echo Chamber is a broad comedy, which I'd never written before. And A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom is sort of a very strange time-slipping kind of novel. But I've never felt that the people... I think you're right in what you're saying. And the people it really affects the most, I think, unfortunately, are women writers. And I have a lot of women writer friends who that publishers very much want them to stay in a kind of a romantic mode, especially if that woman writer has, in the first instance, become successful through a romantic novel, say. Then they're not given the freedom, I think, that male writers are to expand, to broaden their horizons. Now, there are women writers who sort of very initially are taken seriously on a literary front, and nobody really knows the mystery behind that or why. But there are others that aren't, and I know that can be very frustrating for a lot of my friends.
That's so interesting. Now, Boy in the Striped Pajamas, when I've been explaining to non-book people who I'm interviewing today and why we're so excited, I've had to refer to Boy in the Striped Pajamas. Do you have a sense of why that book? What was it that made that magic happen?
It's so difficult. It's 20 years ago almost since the book was published, and there's rarely a day in my life goes by that I don't have to answer a question about it one way or another. Looking back, I think there's a few things came together. I think there was, I was 33 when I wrote the first draft of that. I was still relatively new to the publishing game, the writing game. There was an innocence, almost a naivety to it. I hadn't read young adult books since I was a young adult, and I was writing one without really knowing what I suppose I call the rules of YA literature. So I was, that was something different. Also, I think the friendship at the heart of that book between Bruno and Shmuel is something that just people really, really cared about, and they liked them and didn't want to see anything bad happen to them. And then something does. And the ending of that book, which is so stark, and there's only like two pages once you've read that ending. I think at the time, it was certainly one of those books that people would get to the end of and go, what? You know, and then they would want to give it to someone to read and say, I can't tell you anything, but I want you to read this. And then we'll talk about it. And those kind of books don't come along very often. But I think it was just, it was a stroke of good fortune on my part that I had the idea. I wrote the first draft quite quickly. It came together in a very organic way, and it just touched people. And, you know, my life, I feel like my life really began that day that I finished the first draft of that book.
And does it sometimes feel like a burden, that book following you around, being wanting to be spoken about day after day after day?
Never, never. And I would never sort of shut down questions on it. I know it's the book that people know me best for. It will always be. You know, I could write anything. I could win any prize, but it will still be, you know, The Day I Die, author of The Boy in the Striped Pajamas Died, you know, and that's fine. The fact that I have one of those books is great, and I'm very proud of it. And because it's on a serious subject, you know, that's important. So I never wanted to turn something that was such a positive experience in my life into a negative.
Right. So it has been the subject of some criticism. And I, at the time that I read the criticism, which was years ago, instantly formulated a defense in my mind, which I still stick to. So the criticism is that this is not realistic. The two boys would not have ended up in the camp, but what ends up happening to them could not possibly have happened. And this isn't a realistic depiction of the Holocaust. So what would your response be? I've always been interested to know, how do you respond to that?
Fiona's really, really hoping that her response is your response.
Okay. Well, no, because I have heard the criticism, and firstly, I would say I'm completely open to criticism. I think every book should be open to criticism, and we can accept it or say, no, I don't agree with what you're saying. But my response would be, firstly, on the title page of the book, there's two very important words under the words The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. And those two words are a fable. Right? So it is a fable. It is a work of fiction with a moral at the center. Fiction is not supposed to always represent exactly the world in which we live in. It is one small step removed from the real world. If I set a novel inside a concentration camp, the minute I put a fictional character into it, that world is already corrupted. That fictional character never existed. Is it likely that two boys would be in that camp? Well, one of them, yes, because Rudolf Huss, the commandant at Auschwitz, did in fact have his children there. Is it likely that Shmuel would be there? It's very unlikely, but it is possible. Some children were kept alive, for their fingers were small. They were able to fill these little bullets, you know. They were kept alive for medical experimentation. We see the documentaries of the liberation of the camps, and we do see children there. So it's possible, but unlikely. But even if it was completely impossible, I don't think that matters. For me, I've always thought, over the last 20 years, a whole generation of kids has grown up, and at the risk of sounding arrogant, all around the world, and they've read that book in schools, and it has given them some insight and some understanding of the existence of the Holocaust. And perhaps that one in every 10 has gone on then and said, I'd like to learn more about that, and have then gone on to the Anne Franks and the Elie Wiesels and the Primo Levis and all the other great ones. All I ever wrote was a story for children. And it became this phenomenon. And one other criticism that has come across, because the Auschwitz Memorial have been clear on this, is they say that it should not be read by anybody studying the Holocaust. But I did not write a textbook. You know, I didn't write a book to be used in schools or universities. I just wrote a novel for kids that spread out into something broader. And I'm proud of that. And there is nothing anybody can say. I've heard all the different criticisms, but there is nothing that anybody can say that will ever change my mind about it. I'm really proud of the book.
That is exactly the defense that I formulated in my mind. And, you know, for many of us, Gail and I, for our children, it was their first kind of visceral introduction to the Holocaust. They perhaps knew what it was, but studying that book at school would be their first real introduction. And Gail is Jewish and she can speak about this. But for me, I'm so glad that that is the thing they will remember, their first visceral impression of the Holocaust and the camps and what happened. They will think of those two little boys.
And I'll just say one other thing. The most important, truthful thing in the book is the ending. Because I didn't save the kids, you know, I didn't let them, you know, skip off home and live happily ever after. The realities of the camps, we know what those realities were. And that's the most authentic part of the book.
So then you've had a massive success like that. And now you have to carry on writing under that shadow. Was it difficult? How did you kind of find almost the strength to do that?
If anything, it was the opposite of difficult, because my life suddenly changed very, very quickly. You know, the first month of 2006 when it was published, we were getting offers from publishers all over the world. Suddenly I was getting invitations to festivals all over the world. Everything changed within about a few weeks for me. And the one thing that kept me grounded, kept me steady all the way through it, was that no matter where I was going, no matter what I was doing, I always had a book I was working on. And I was just working on the next thing. And I think I'd been around long enough, both as a bookseller and then as a published writer, to know this does not happen with every book. This is something different. Don't expect this every time. If it had been my debut novel and it had come out when I was 25, then things might have been different. I might have thought, I should get this every single time, sell millions and millions and millions. But I knew that's not realistic. All I wanted then was the freedom to write the books I want to write. And I've had that ever since. So it was never a burden. It goes back to what I said a few minutes ago about never letting something positive turn into a negative. Just appreciate the good fortune that you had with that.
I'm very interested always in, for a writer like you who writes adult novels, young adult novels, you've written children's books, you've written short stories. When an idea comes to you, do you have to play with that idea but to figure out which form it's going to take, or is that part of the idea coming to you?
It's usually part of the idea. And I don't know about both of you, but like I keep a list of ideas, you know, in a notebook, most of which I'll never get to use. You know, I'm pretty good at kind of coming up with ideas. They come to me quite regularly, most of which I won't get to use. But I find when I'm getting close to the end of a book that I'm writing, as in the copy edits and all of that, I find one idea is kind of jumping up and down in my head without me reaching out to grab one. There's one that's jumping up and saying, me, now is the time to write me. And I will instinctively know a lot about that in the sense of, who is it, an adult novel? Is it a young person novel? I also have this kind of pretty decent sense of how long a book should be, depending on the subject matter. Like the book I'm writing at the moment is a long book. It's about the length of Hearts Invisible Furies, which is 203,000 words. And sometimes, like with this most recent quartet, I knew I wanted them all to be short, 40,000. So I've a good instinct about that. So the idea is very connected to the type of book.
Can you talk to us about your relationship with social media? How it's changed, how it's evolved. Did you ever love it? Did you learn to hate it? Did you fall back in love with it? As authors, there's a kind of understanding that we're supposed to engage with the public through this social media platform. And I know that you've had some run-ins with people on it. Just talk to us about that.
At the start, I did like it. I thought it was, I'll talk mostly about Twitter because that's the one I would use, and Instagram. But Instagram is lovely. Nobody ever says anything mean on there. It's just nice photographs. On Twitter, at the start, I thought it was great. I could connect with readers, connect with other writers. I could share the books I was reading and read about other people's books. And I had never had any kind of controversy in my career until 2019, when I wrote a YA book called My Brother's Name is Jessica, which was about a trans teenager. And writing that, you know, I didn't realize what a storm it was going to cause. A few years later down the line now, I mean, obviously it seems to be a subject that just enrages people. And I got a lot of very unpleasant messages on Twitter at the time. And I probably didn't respond well to them because they were, it wasn't the kind of criticism you might find in a book review where somebody might write something and you might go, well, you know what, actually, that's right. You know, I did mess up that character or something. It was just ad hominem attacks. You know, it was people telling me that I was this, that, and the other without ever knowing anything about me. Most of them said, I haven't read the book and I won't read it, but I still feel I can, you know, comment on it. There was death threats. There was, you know, it was pretty disgusting. So I left it for a long time. Then I went back to it. And now I find, and then I wrote a novel about it. I wrote The Echo Chamber about the whole thing and turned it into a farce. Now I'm back on it and I don't really get much negativity anymore. But when anybody says anything negative, I just block them. You know, I just don't really bother engaging. I think time has moved on with social media.
I want to talk about The Echo Chamber because I don't just think it's a funny novel. I think it is the funny novel. I think it's the funniest novel ever written. And it is, your books have a gentle humor, but writing an outright funny book was a new experiment for you. How did you even go about doing it? And then with such success?
Oh, well, I knew I wanted to write about the Jessica experience, as I said, not just about the way people had spoken to me, but the way I had responded to it. And it was at that point where social media was just so insane and so many people were suffering on it, either by being abused or, I have to say, sometimes so many of the people who abuse people on social media, they're victims of it themselves. They've lost their minds, half of them, you know, sitting on it all day, screaming at complete strangers. I mean, what do you gain out of it? So I decided to write this and I knew at the start that I had to make it a complete farce. And I told myself, I want one laugh out loud line on every page. And I thought, if I make this kind of a poor me book, you know, the way I was treated, it's not going to work. It's just going to feel so self-pitying. It's that I have to make this family, there's five people in this family, just the biggest group of idiots that have ever existed. You know, that all five of them, the parents, the three kids, they're just idiots, all five of them, but their hearts are in the right places and they're doing their best and they're all using social media in ridiculous ways. And during the week that book takes place, at some point all of them need their family, but their family aren't there because their heads are always stuck in their phones. And it was great fun once I started it. I think sometimes if you start doing something you've never done before, like I'd never written this broad comedy, once that part of your brain opens to it, it all sort of floods out. And I was just coming up with jokes left, right and center. I thought it was going to be a stand-up by the end of it. And I think of all my books, it's probably got the most universal 100% positive reviews. Everybody who read it, anybody who reviewed it, you know, everybody was just like, we loved it. It's just, it's funny because it satirizes something, but there's no self-pity in it.
You've talked about having a high degree of trust in yourself as a writer and knowing that even if you're not quite sure where this is going, you're going to get there. You trust yourself to get there. But it seems to me that your publishers have a great deal of trust in you as well because you've been able to do these pivots throughout your career. So I'm interested to know, especially like these last four novellas, novellas are a hard sell. And novellas about abuse are an even harder sell. Did you have to sort of persuade them, or have you earned this degree of trust from your publishers that they're willing to follow you more or less anywhere?
Well, other than my first three books, I've been with the same publisher and the same editor all through. So for about 20 years, we've worked together and I trust him, he trusts me. Anything he says to me about the books, 99% of the time I agree with. So we do have a great relationship in that sense. And when I decide what I'm writing next, I generally sit down with him and I say, look, this is the basic idea. And over those years, he's trusted me enough to say, okay, all right, well, let me know when you've got a draft ready to read. So with these four, what I did was I wrote before presenting the idea to him, because you're right, it is commercially, it didn't seem like the most sensible idea. And I also thought it'd be quite expensive, you know, for a publisher to do this. But so what I did was I wrote Water, the first one. I wrote a draft of it anyway, the 40,000 words. And I presented that to him with the concept of the other three for the quartet. And I said what I wanted to do was publish them every 6 months as small hardbacks. And then at the end, you know, put it all together. And he was like, okay, well, all right then. So he went away and he read Water. And then we sat down and he said, let's do it. Yeah, there wasn't even a moment of doubt. I think it was sensible for me to actually give him a... I think he probably would have trusted me anyway. But it just made more sense for me to give him one and say, this is what I'm... This is the style it's going to be in. And he liked that very much. And from then, it was great. And they did such a beautiful job on the production values, I think, on it. Those jackets and they look so beautiful all lined up together now. And they've been very happy because the fear, of course, is with a sequence, usually the sales will decrease on each one. And the fear was that was would happen and you'd get to the fourth one and nobody's buying it anymore. But actually, it went the other way. Each one started selling more than the last one. And Air has just gone in at number one back home. And the first one went in at three, the last two went to number two, and this one finally went to number one. So it increased with each one. And I think that's a combination of, firstly, I think they look beautiful in the bookshops, but the reviews were great and people kind of got behind the series. I think every 6 months made sense. I think if it had been every year, it could have fallen off a little bit, but 6 months made sense.
And process-wise, how did you pull that off? Did you write them all before...
No, I didn't. No, I mean, Water was in the shops before I even was writing Fire. You know, I was probably starting Fire anyway. So I knew I would have to live with whatever I'd already written and that the stories would have to, because a minor character from each becomes the narrator of the next one, I couldn't change anything from past parts of it. The third one, I'd say, was the most difficult, both in terms of the narrative voice in my head, that of a female paedophile, and carrying that around for 8 months. I had two written. I still had one to come. That was the moment where I thought, this is a heavy undertaking. But, you know, that's the job, you know, and I had to, and I knew my deadlines if I was going to do this. You know, I'd set it to start November, May, and there was no backing out really once I was in. So I just had to sit down. But there were, honestly, of every book I've ever written, that was the toughest. And then once I got to Air, the last one, the end was in sight. And also it has a lighter tone than the three previous ones. And I was able to kind of draw all the strands together a little bit at the end. And now that I've finished them and now that they're all out there, I feel both a sense of relief that I've written about this topic and I feel I've written it out of my system, the subject of abuse. But I also feel like I feel proud of the four together. I think that they're an interesting collection, enabling, complicity, perpetrator, victim. And I think as a foursome, if I say so myself, I think they work well.
Right. So you've written about it in fiction form, and you've also written columns about your own experience of abuse. And I would imagine that there is a difference between sitting in front of your own screen and writing about this very, very difficult subject. It's you and your device and you writing things. And once you've put things out there, you've put things on the page or in the media, people feel as though, oh, okay, he's put it all out there. You know, it's all fair game. But I would imagine that having strangers in interviews day after day after day, like us, you know, probing you and asking you and talking to you, that's a very different experience. Did you feel that disjuncture? Is it difficult to be asked over and over and over again about this very, very difficult stuff?
No, it's not, because I knew when I set out to write these that I was going to be writing about something personal, something that happened to me when I was a kid or when I was a teenager, and that if I was going to write the novels, then I had to be able to stand up behind the novels and speak about my own experience. I don't just want people to read them to, you know, to lose themselves in a story. I also want there to be people who might read them who might find some catharsis themselves in it, and that they will maybe they have a story to tell that they need to go to the police to tell about. Maybe it would give them that strength to do that, and it would be pointless of me to write them without being able to say, look, here's my story. This is what happened when I was a teenager in school. Here's the effect it had on me. Here's how long that effect lasted. Here's when I got help for it. Here's when I reported it. And here's where I am now. right? And that's the responsibility that goes with writing a book like this or like those. So no, I think it's I feel the sense of responsibility, as I say, but I feel it's been a cathartic experience for me.
I'm interested if that sense of responsibility also extends to other books, because you go to dark, dark places in some of your books. You do it beautifully, but you go to dark places. The one that stayed with me the most is The History of Loneliness. Have I got the title right? That book haunted me.
And that was the first novel I wrote that was actually set in Ireland. And I was about 10 books in at that point. So it took that long for me to feel confident about writing something set in my own country.
And something so dark, but with such sensitivity. When you sit down to write a book like that, do you feel a sense of responsibility and do you feel a weight about it?
I certainly feel the responsibility. I'm not sure a weight. I feel, I have to say, I feel excited almost by it, you know. When I wrote History of Loneliness, for example, I remember writing the first draft of that. And even though it is a dark book, the truth is it was very pleasurable to write because of the fact that I was finally writing about the streets I grew up in, happy experiences of childhood, places I knew in Ireland. I was opening a part of my brain that I hadn't used before, when I was writing about, you know, the Russian Tsars or the Holocaust or the Wild West or something. You know, it was a completely different thing. And so you can actually enjoy writing something quite dark. And, you know, the strange thing is, because in real life, I'm actually a pretty happy-go-lucky guy and I'm pretty cheerful about things. But yeah, there is a lot of darkness in my books, I guess, but maybe that's where it comes out. I'm not sure. But I don't set out thinking I want to make something bleak or I want a really sad ending. I just set out to write something authentic. And if that means that it has to be sad or it has to have a tragic ending, then so be it. Or if it means that I can have a positive, a more uplifting ending. I don't think it's any spoilers to say that the end of this sequence ends on a more positive note, which I thought was really important, because I did want somebody to, when you get to the victim story, I wanted to end on a positive note to say that you can survive this and you don't have to let your whole life be defined by something. So I still find the whole act of writing a joyful one for me.
I think you've answered the question. I didn't know if I was asking that. Is it still fun even when
it is. I mean, and it gets more fun all the time. I don't know if you ever found this, but I sometimes feel I say that a book is written in reaction to the last one. So if you take the last one of mine being those four, the book I'm writing at the moment, those four are first person, contemporary, short, dark. What I'm writing at the moment is third person, historical, funny, dramatic, and reasonably light. So it's, you're using a different part of the, you need to kind of like shake off one thing and put on a different set of clothes or something, you know, in the next book. And I love that. I enjoy it.
We've interviewed writers who find the material they're dealing with so distressing that their own mental health becomes compromised and they have to sort of resort to various tricks to protect their mental health while they're dealing with this difficult stuff. Do you have any particular way of doing that, or is your sort of cheerful nature enough to sustain you?
Yeah, I haven't really had that experience. You know, I mentioned that Fire, of all the books I've written, was the most emotionally challenging to write because of the narrative voice. But I wouldn't say it comes anywhere near to what you're saying about some other writers might feel. I'm perfectly fine to just go for a walk in the park and clear my mind. And I'm able to kind of look at it and say, this is a book, you know, and I have to step away slightly and look at it and think, not about my own mind and all that, that I'm trying to write something that is going to work for a reader, that these characters, this dialogue, this storyline, that it all holds together. There isn't any sort of like moment that just doesn't, that you're going to feel, nah, that's not realistic, that wouldn't happen. So I haven't really found myself to date, hopefully never will, in that position.
I'm very interested. So when I was a youngish writer, I went to a talk by Jeffrey Archer, and he talked about that there are writers who write beautiful sentences and there are writers who write a good story, and every now and then there's a writer who can do both. And for me, it was important because it gave me permission to write a good story without writing beautiful sentences. But you do both. And I'm interested in how you do, like, how aware of you are you of the story on a sentence level as you're writing, or is writing beautifully something that just comes naturally?
I must admit, I'm not that aware on a sentence level. I'm not constantly looking for a great metaphor or anything like that. I am, when I am working on each draft, I am incredibly focused on it. I often read it aloud in order to hear the rhythm of the sentences. I often say to creative writing students, read your stuff aloud, you'll hear different things in it. I'm very, very focused on it, but I don't think I have the kind of brain that is always looking for that beautiful phrase. Maybe if one appears, it's appearing because I've blocked everything else out and I'm absolutely laser beam on what I'm doing. But I do consider myself a storyteller more than anything else. That's like, I think stories are underrated. I don't think we should always notice the architecture. I think as a reader, I just want to be lost inside the book. And I think a lot of it should come on the subconscious level.
It's such an interesting decision to approach abuse from the point of view of the person who turns a blind eye, the enabler, the abuser, the victim. And I've just recently been reading critics who talk about the concept of radical empathy. In other words, that if you want to understand someone, it's not enough just to read their writings and hear what they say, but you actually have to think yourself into the persona of that person, and that writing as that person is the most radical form of empathy. So when you set out on this project, did you know that you were going to be able to do it from the beginning? And what did it teach you to inhabit these very, some of them very dark personalities?
Well, at the risk of sounding narcissistic, yes, I knew I would be able to do it, that if I set out to do it, I would do it. I know myself in that way, and I trust myself as a writer in that way. What it taught me was that to not write complete monsters, that there's no point, it's boring to just write pure evil. Most of us are not pure evil or pure saints. You know, we're all somewhere on a... We all try to do our best in life, but I bet for everybody listening to this, all of us, the three of us here, there are probably things in our life that we can look back on and feel ashamed of, you know, things we wish we'd never done. And there are moments that we can look back and say that was like one of my greatest moments as a human being to do that. So I think what I wanted was not to demonize the people in, particularly in the second and third book, but to find some human empathetic way into what might have led them to behave in this repulsive fashion. So I think, yeah, I guess in terms of a writer, it taught me more about human characters. And I think if I keep going all the way to my 90s or something, I hope I'm still learning all the way.
John, I'm going to ask an unfair question. I'm going to ask you to choose your favorite child. Which of your books, you know, and I'm sure, and we all get asked this, but I am very curious, which of your books is the one that just holds that special place in your heart and you think you always will, and you're not allowed to choose Striped Pajamas?
It's not Striped Pajamas. It's not. It's The Heart's Invisible Furies. That's the one that I feel most proud of. I think it's, in terms of what it accomplished artistically for me, that combination of comedy, drama and tragedy. I think the narrative voice of Cyril Avery works well. And I think the study of Ireland over those 70 years and how it changed in terms of social life, gay rights and so on, it's hands down my favourite of my own books.
Oh, that's nice that you do have a favourite child.
I have a very close second, which is A Ladder to the Sky, the one about publishing. I think that's a good one, but Hearts is first.
As someone who's created a couple of fictional islands in my time, I was interested to see that you created this unnamed island in the quartet that you set. Well, it's a kind of launch pad for many of the stories. And I know why I like islands, but why do you like to create a fictional island?
I think what was very helpful for me about water and using that small island, which is actually based, I never name it, but it's based on one of the Aran Islands, the smallest one. If I named it, I wouldn't have the freedom to, you know, people would say, well, this road doesn't go this way or this car wouldn't be able to go, whatever, you know. So it's a small island, but I thought, You've got very few people on it. The Wi-Fi isn't great. So people are left in conversation a lot of the times. Everybody knows each other's business. A stranger rolls into town. Who's she? What's she about? What's her story? People trying to figure it out. But the rest of the world just not getting in on top of it. And for my character, Willow, who really wants to leave the world behind and ask herself really serious questions about the last quarter century of her life, the peace, the serenity of that place and the people that she comes in contact with give her the opportunity to do that.
I want to ask about writing advice. I want to ask if you have a few gems of wisdom, because we have a lot of writers and wannabe writers who listen to this podcast. Those gems of wisdom that you think are the best writing advice you have.
Okay, firstly, no matter how dark your subject matter is, try to get some jokes in. The reader needs it sometimes to just break the tension. And you can use humor to really dig down into something dark anyway. Even in Striped Pajamas, there's humor in there with Bruno's misunderstandings and things. Secondly, I mentioned earlier about reading your work aloud and being able to hear the rhythm of the sentences, hear whether you've repeated words, hear whether the dialogue just isn't ringing true. So read stuff aloud. And the sooner you can get people talking to each other in a book as well, I build character through dialogue. That's where I find my characters mostly. How do they respond to other people's conversation? What will they say? Are they defensive? Are they aggressive? Are they self-deprecating? Are they funny? What are they? I prefer that. I like that way of building a character.
This is your second Franschhoek Literary Festival, am I correct?
That's right. Yeah, 10 years ago, 2015 was my first.
Can you tell us your impressions of South Africa?
Well, first time I came here in 2015, I saw Cape Town as well and Johannesburg and here, obviously, Franschhoek. And the three were so different. And they are so different to me. And Franschhoek is such a beautiful, it's smaller, obviously. And it's just walking the streets and looking at those mountains around me. It's sort of idyllic in a way that something has to be a favorite, in a way that I felt Cape Town and Johannesburg aren't as idyllic, you know, to walk around in. But it's lovely to come back. The people are incredibly friendly. You know, I did my first event here this morning. The 250 people, I think, at it. And it's just beautiful. I find the people friendly. I find the town here in Franschhoek wonderful. I'll come back in 10 years again.
And when you come back in 10 years, please come to Johannesburg again. We've been left out.
So, John, can you tell us what you have been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on you?
Yeah, I'm almost at the end of a novel that is genuinely one of the best books that I've ever read in my life. And I'm late to the party on this one. It's about 10 years old. And it's The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. And I started it about 3 or 4 days ago and then was reading it on the flight coming over. And, you know, in my room this morning, I'm about 50 pages to go. And I can't remember the last time I was so affected by a book. It's so beautifully written and it's so powerful and so moving and so sad. You know, I don't know if you've read it, but it's like, and this, the whole history of slavery in America through this character of Cora, I think it's beautiful. Music wise, I've always loved Elton John, but over the last year to 18 months, I've done this kind of like deep dive into all the albums and all the songs. It's like 750 songs and all the songs that I didn't know and all the kind of like bootlegs and all this type of thing. And it's been kind of like a little passion project over the last 18 months, finding all these wonderful Elton John songs that I've never known before. And watching, this is probably not going to sound great, but I've, in the last 6 months, I don't know why, I've become addicted to these true crime things on Netflix, you know, and these sort of 3 or 4 parters and about murders, and it's usually domestic. And, you know, people going missing or wives killing husbands, husbands killing wives. And it's, I don't know what, I've just become hooked on them. It's probably a terrible thing to admit.
So for the aficionados in that genre, what have you been watching? Do you have favorites?
Well, there was one, last week I watched, there was one called A Deadly American Marriage, which is actually about an Irish, do you see it?
My husband's watching.
Yeah. And it was an Irish guy who went to the States, had married an American woman. He was originally widowed. And then the woman and her father killed the husband. And they claim, I mean, they did get sent down for it and everything, but they claim they didn't, that he, like, they did it in self-defense and everything. But and at the time, it was a big story in Ireland because the kids then were repatriated to Ireland. So it was a big story. So that was a very interesting one.
Well, John, we hope that everybody checks out the four parts of the Elements series. I've just finished Air this morning, and I think it's a tour de force. I absolutely loved every one of them. And we hope people check out your backlist because, as we know, it is so incredibly rewarding and there's so much richness there. But thank you so much for your time. This has been amazing.
Thanks for having me on.
Gail, I feel so incredibly lucky to have had an hour to sit down with the John Boyne and talk to him.
I'm feeling a bit like I have to pinch myself. I can't quite believe it. And we had him like just us. We didn't have to share him with a whole panel. He just came and spoke to us and said our names, Fiona.
We're both still a bit starstruck.
Fiona, it's unfair almost to ask what we got out of that because there was so much in that and so much useful. Oh, and I'm so glad I asked for writing advice things. But what did you get out of that?
Well, you asked him about, you know, writing beautiful sentences versus constructing a gripping plot, and that he's someone who does both, and he very much is someone who does both. And then he replied by saying that if you are too aware of the architecture of what you're doing, it probably is going to become too conscious, too mannered, and that something's going to go wrong at that point. And he implied that his beautiful sentences, which are incredibly beautiful, kind of come naturally in the process of creating the plot, and he's not searching around for the perfect metaphor all the time. And I think that is the way to do it. Think about telling your story and not how to be this beautiful, perfect literary writer.
I think that was really important. That was one of the things that caught in my mind. And I think you sometimes see it. I'm reading a book at the moment, actually, where I feel the author is a little bit too caught up in beautiful adjectives. Like, I honestly, if I read another adjective in this book, I might have to do a small vomit. And there's definitely going to be another adjective because I'm not finished the book. So, yeah, I think 100% that was a really, really interesting point.
And you, what did you get from it?
So I was very interested in how he talked about the expectations he had as a first-time writer, that he was just thrilled it was published, versus the expectations he would have had if he'd had a big hit, versus the expectations that a lot of debut writers have now. And it really struck home to me because I think it's true for South African debut writers even more than for internationally published people, that really, this book that you have slaved over for years, that you think is the beginning of the rest of your life, and you think you've written Boy in the Striped Pajamas, and actually you most likely haven't. And most likely what's going to happen is it's going to sell a depressingly low number of copies, and then it's going to be off the shelf pretty soon, and nobody's going to think about it. And it's really quite sad and depressing. And it just struck me, it almost comforted me. That is an international norm.
Yeah, and he said, I think, that it is harder to get your fourth or fifth book published than to get your first book published. And that wasn't something I realized when I was a debut author. I thought once you've cracked that door open, it will be open to you for the rest of your life, and that is not true at all.
And, you know, I even thought it – I thought it till very recently, if I could just – if I could have the breakthrough novel that we were all waiting for, that's going to make us into John Boyne, that then you guaranteed. And I listen to a lot of podcasts where it becomes clear you're never there until you're dead as a writer. You know, the next book could be a flop. You could go out of fashion. You know, there's so many things that could go wrong. You could by mistake write something that gets you cancelled and that's the end of you. And I find it bizarrely comforting rather than frightening. There was another thing that comforted me, Fiona, and I was interested if you had a reaction to this, that he said he recognized that men have more leeway to change what type of things they write, and women are asked to be in a box, and once you've chosen your box, you better stay in your box. And I found that bizarrely comforting. I don't know. I can't even put my finger on why I found it comforting, but I did. Maybe it was just someone voicing it and recognizing it. Did that resonate for you?
Very much so. And it keeps going round in my mind. And I think the net effect of it is depressing because it's so recognizable and so true. You know, women writers are commercial products. How is she going to make us a lot of money? How is she going to tap into this market that's going to generate so much money? Whereas men have the freedom to be artists and to develop their career and to do whatever it is that they feel like doing. And it is a trap. I mean, I wouldn't say no to being that wonderful money spinner.
we don't mind being caught in the trap. Any international publishers listening to us, put us in the trap, please.
But it was recognizable, and he really hit on a nerve there. He really did.
It was very interesting, like everything he said to you, and I have to say that was really one of the highlights of my career.
This interview has been a highlight of our careers. I think we'd both agree with that. So for the legions of fans out there who've read John Boyne's books, who've listened to his writing advice, who've listened to his talking about his process and how he weaves these wonderful stories, please get in touch with us. We would love to hear from you. We're on all social media across the board, and we want to know your thoughts.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.